Leader!
Order, order.
An extraordinary week in the House, with MPs returning from a week's adjournment on Tuesday to question times dominated by claims of an economy in crisis in the wake of falling dairy prices. The spotlight falling on the two smallest parties, ACT and United Future, on Wednesday, when their leaders played critical roles on Members' Day. And on Thursday, the government calling time on its coal mine, Solid Energy, before scoring a parliamentary first when the Prime Minister, John Key, tried to join in the debate on the third and final reading of the New Zealand flag referendums bill via Twitter, attracting a scathing response from Labour's Trevor Mallard.
Mr Speaker, I'm an old-fashioned parliamentarian, and I think the role of the Prime Minister is to stand up in this Parliament and to state his views. I waited through the first reading of this legislation. I waited through the second reading of this legislation. I waited through the committee stages for John Key to get on his feet and to give his views. Mr Speaker, I was waiting for the Prime Minister to give his views as part of this debate. And what did I see? What did I see? He decided to contribute to this debate in this House by way of Twitter. He would not stand up on his hind legs in this Parliament and give his views. And, Mr Speaker, for a Prime Minister of a country with a pet project, that shows to me a lack of commitment to a parliamentary democracy.
Labour's Trevor Mallard, who had led his party's opposition to the bill, which enables the government to hold two postal referendums on changing the design of the country's flag. Labour was joined in opposing the bill by New Zealand First and the Greens, their 57 votes defeated by the 63 of National, the Māori Party, ACT and United Future. The same arithmetic finally brought to an end the annual estimates debate, which entered its 11th hour after questions on Thursday. The estimates debate began on July the 21st and, after being interrupted several times, ended on Thursday with National supported by the three parties with which it has formal agreements on votes of confidence and supply. Otherwise, they are free to vote as they please, and Wednesday found the Māori Party across the floor voting with the opposition, joined once by the United Future MP for Ohau, Peter Dunn, who for the second Members' Day in a row supported the passage of a Labour bill to a select committee by that slimmest of margins, 61 votes to 60. Rhys Lyon reports.
That bill was the Minimum Wage Contractor Remuneration Amendment Bill in the name of Labour's David Parker, who said it was the first bill he had had drawn from the ballot in his more than 13 years at Parliament. The bill aims to bring the rate of remuneration for contractors into line with the minimum wage. A precursor to Mr Parker's bill had been drafted by him when he was a minister in the previous Labour government and had been introduced as a member's bill by then Labour MP Darian Fenton. That version of the bill had gone to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee, which made a series of recommendations for improvement. However, the bill lapsed at the end of the Labour government's term in office, and Mr Parker said the legislation he was introducing included the improvements made by the Select Committee. Towards the end of the bill's reading on Wednesday night, Mr Parker had this to say.
I don't know what the outcome of this vote will be, Mr Speaker. I know it will be close. I think this is worthy of consideration with the Select Committee. Can I say to the National members that if this bill does pass first reading and goes to Select Committee, why don't you try and make it work rather than try to demolish it?
As it happened, the bill did pass its first reading by the narrow margin of 61 votes to 60, progressing with the support of United Future's Peter Dunn, along with Labour, the Māori Party, New Zealand First and the Greens, and was sent off to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee for consideration. And the next member's bill up for debate on Wednesday night, Labour MP Stuart Nash's Local Government Act 2002, Greater Local Democracy Amendment Bill, which would reinstate the requirement for a poll of affected electors to ensure support for changes to the organisation of local authorities, failed to pass its first reading by 61 votes to 60, defeated by the combined votes of National, ACT and United Future. Then it was on to the first reading of National MP Matt Ducey's Public Collections and Solicitations Disclosure of Payment Bill, which seeks to bring more transparency to donation collectors. That bill passed on a voice vote and was sent to the Social Services Committee.
That report from Rhys Lyon and the vacancies created on the members' order paper were filled on Thursday when three more bills were drawn from the 71 entries in the ballot. The lucky trio were the Affordable Healthcare Bill from New Zealand First MP Barbara Stewart, the Keep Kiwibank Bill in the name of Labour's Clayton Cosgrove, and the Electricity Industry Small-Scale Renewable Distributed Generation Amendment Bill from the Greens' Gareth Hughes. The only other way for an ordinary MP to get a members' bill up for debate is to seek the leave of the House to table it in the chamber. Requests for leave can be blocked by an objection from any one member, and as a result, they're seldom granted. The last members' bill to bypass the ballot and be introduced by leave was in 2008. Undaunted, the ACT member for Epsom, David Seymour, made this request before question time on Tuesday.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to introduce a members' bill in my name on extending the licensing hours for the sale and supply of alcohol for the duration of the Rugby World Cup 2015 to be set down for first reading as members' order number one tomorrow. To allow it to commence prior to the start of the Rugby World Cup, I also seek leave for the bill following first reading to be referred to the Justice and Electoral Committee for 2 weeks and, once reported back, for the bill to be given its second and third readings forthwith on the following Members' Day, 26 August 2015.
Leave is sought for that purpose. Is there any objection? There is. Order. Order. There is objection.
As objections to requests for leave can come from any one member, they're usually not identified, as the Speaker reminded Ron Mark when the New Zealand First Party's Deputy Leader made this request on Thursday.
Point of order, Ron Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to move a motion without notice regarding the 70th anniversary of victory in Japan and the end of the Second World War, which will fall this Saturday, this weekend.
Leave is sought for that particular purpose. Is there any objection? There is objection.
Yes, point of order.
Point of order, Ron Mark.
Mr. Speaker, I take it that the Hansard will record that the Minister of Defence objected.
Order. That is not a point of order. Any member can object. It is not then appropriate for the member to rise and identify. That creates disorder in this House, and frankly, the member knows it.
Nevertheless, the identity of the objector to David Seymour's request was immediately revealed to be the Greens' Kevin Haigh, who explained his reasons when Mr. Seymour succeeded in his second attempt on Wednesday, and his bill went straight into its first reading.
There is a regime that we set up in the law for special licences. And in its report, the Law Commission, in fact, uses international rugby fixtures as an example of the kind of special event that would be appropriate for the use of special licences. And those members of the House who were present for the debate in 2012 may well recall that actually our debate also specifically talked about the Rugby World Cup and its appropriate use for special licences. And certainly there's nothing at all in the existing law that actually would prevent special licences being used for Rugby World Cup fixtures. So that's the appropriate mechanism. So why is there a problem now, Mr. Speaker? Well, it turns out that the police in some parts of New Zealand are saying that Rugby World Cup fixtures do not qualify for the special licences. Now, what that suggests to me and to the Green Party is that what we need is a review of how Parliament's intentions around special licences have been implemented. And, Mr. Speaker, that's how we should proceed. But we don't have time right now. What we have to do right now is actually address the fact that the Rugby World Cup is just around the corner. We saw David Seymour's bill for the first time yesterday morning. We denied leave for it to be introduced yesterday because we had major concerns. We are now confident, Mr. Speaker, that as a result of the discussions we've had with David Seymour, the assurances he's given us, and also the good faith discussions that we've had with government, that the issues that we had around a bill that that covered all games, in other words, most days over a six-week period, and all licensed premises, including those operated by licensees who'd previously breached licences, including those that were in locations that were just around the corner from a kindy, that those issues are in fact going to be dealt with.
And the Greens' Kevin Hague will see how well they've been dealt with when the bill is reported back from the Justice and Electoral Committee on Wednesday, August the 26th, leaving just one day for its passage into law before the start of a week's adjournment. One of the main themes of Question Times this week was the state of the economy in the wake of falling dairy prices. Finance Minister Bill English rejected opposition claims of a crisis.
No, I mean, when people use the word crisis, well, the opposition should explain what that means. If they think it means dairy farmers are sitting around with their head in their hands, paralysed by low prices, then they're wrong. Actually, they're getting up every morning, out into the cold, wet weather, doing the calving, milking the cows, spending the money they need to get their production moving and get their product to world markets.
The Finance Minister's assurances buttered no parsnips for his Labour shadow, Grant Robertson.
If ever there was an image to sum up the lazy, incompetent, complacent economic management of the National Government, it was this image here from the front of the Westpac quarterly economic survey released yesterday. A boat run aground, an economy run aground, Mr. Speaker.
Grant Robertson was followed in Wednesday's general debate by National's Judith Collins.
My goodness, that Grant Robertson's good, isn't he? He is good. He is so good. Why isn't he the leader of the Labour Party? He has tried three times, and three times he's been rejected. And I think it's because he'll never make it with women because he calls me ginger when clearly I'm blonde. The man just doesn't get it.
Judith Collins said her family had been in dairy farming for generations.
Dairying is important, but it is actually 5% of our economy. It's not the 95% you'd think if you listen to Radio Albania, also known as Radio New Zealand.
Radio New Zealand also featured in a question on Wednesday for the Prime Minister, John Key, from Labour's David Parker.
Why did he not answer the repeated questions on Morning Report this morning about what value New Zealand received for the money paid to the Al Khalaf Group, in particular the $4 million cash payment up front?
Mr. Key said he absolutely had answered the question.
What I did very accurately was start by saying this was a mess created by Labour. And unfortunately, Susie Ferguson didn't want to hear it any more than the Labour Party. But the problem is, it's true.
David Parker's application for a snap debate on the Saudi farmgate business was rejected by the Speaker.
The release of documents pertaining to the government's dealing with a Saudi businessman is a particular case of recent occurrence involving ministerial responsibility. There must be an element of urgency for a matter to take precedent over other business. The proper use of taxpayer funds is an important issue. The question is whether the release of documents is an issue so urgent that the ordinary business of the House should be set aside to address it. I am not persuaded that the business of the House should be set aside today. However, I note that the Auditor-General has been asked to investigate the matter. Should she do so, then the findings of that investigation may warrant a debate in the House at that time. The application is therefore declined.
More opposition requests for an urgent debate followed this announcement on Thursday from the Minister for State-Owned Enterprises, Todd McClay.
Mr. Speaker, today the Board of Solid Energy has placed the company into voluntary administration. This follows months of negotiation with key stakeholders who have agreed to put a proposal to creditors that provides for an orderly sell-down of assets over the next 2.5 years. This decision to place the company into voluntary administration was made after it became clear that even with significant operational improvements, the falling international coal price means there is no prospect of Solid Energy being in a position to repay or refinance its bank debt. Solid Energy owes $320 million of bank debt, some falling due in September of 2016, and overall has exposure of close to $500 million. As a result of the considerable efforts of its board and management, officials and lenders, Solid Energy is certainly a much more efficient and effective business today than it was 2 years ago. But the reality is that there is still no prospect of the company being in a position to repay or refinance its debt or access the capital that it would require to invest for the future. An orderly sales process of Solid Energy gives the best chance that parts of the business can continue to operate under different ownership in the future. If the creditors agree to the proposal, the company will remain solvent during the process and will continue to carry on its normal business under its existing board of directors. Payment of employees and trade creditors will continue on a business-as-usual basis, and customers will continue to have access to coal. Under the terms of the restructure, existing Crown indemnities for site rehabilitation costs are being restructured to assist the sales process and to provide certainty for affected local authorities. Solid Energy is currently exiting and rehabilitating the Pike River mine site. Once it completes this process, the land will be returned to the Department of Conservation. Through the voluntary administration process, Solid Energy remains committed to this work. The government has provided intensive support to the company in an attempt to make it viable in a highly challenging international coal market.
Mr. McLay's defence of his cabinet colleague's oversight of Solid Energy was challenged in the short debate triggered by his ministerial statement. The charge led by his Labour shadow, their spokesman on state-owned enterprises.
The Honourable Clayton Cosgrove.
Mr. Speaker, this is indeed a very, very sad day, and I start by saying this. I hope Tony Ryle, the former Minister of SOEs, wherever he may be, is listening very, very carefully to this. No, no, Mr. Brownlee says Mr. Nasty. The Mr. Nasty in this piece, sir, is a government that ran this company into the ground. Ran this company into the ground. In 2000, between 1999 and 2008, Solid Energy was an export award-winning company delivering hundreds of millions of dollars to the taxpayer. In 2009, the government's first act by the then SOEs minister was to write to that company and demand more dividends. And as a result of that, they took $164 million worth of dividends from that company. They expected them in that letter, sir, which will be tabled later today, to ratchet up their debt level, which they did, sir, to around, I think, $313 million. And then, sir, when the coal price moved and their own scoping consultants, who were in there to scope Solid Energy for sale, reported back in 2009-2010 that the ship was heading for the rocks, they did nothing. They did absolutely nothing. Their alibi, sir, to the New Zealand people for hundreds of millions of dollars of waste, for hundreds and probably more, further hundreds of workers losing their jobs, sir, is, the coal price devalued. Well, that is true. The coal price devalued, the markets dried up. Any village idiot on that side could have read that, sir, in the paper. The question before the New Zealand people that the government has never answered is a simple one. Why, when they saw that happen, why did they not react? Why did they do absolutely nothing? Absolutely nothing, sir. As far as they opened the lid, Mr. English, of course, the photo of Mr. English allowing the outlandish expenditure, opening the lignite plant, sexy coal from Mr. Brownlee, allowing outlandish expenditure where management spent till they dropped, where management and executives, particularly the then CEO, was allowed to get a massive golden handshake for sitting at home. Why did they not react, sir? Other coal companies around the world reacted. I've worked in the minerals industry. I've worked there. I know what happens. I know what happens when the commodity price moves. And companies react within days. And coal companies, sir, around the world reacted at the same time within days, sir, and they are surviving and they are profitable today. These people were derelict in their duty. On the on the 5th of June 2012, Minister English, then Minister Ryle, put the company under month-to-month close watch and still they did nothing. There is a pile of paper, metres high, that the government themselves released from Treasury, from other agencies, warning since 2010 that this company was heading to the rocks. And they have never, ever told the New Zealand people why, unlike their international counterparts, they did not react. They blocked every parliamentary inquiry. The only person that's been able to have a quick look at this was the Auditor General. Yet Mr. Brownlee, interjecting, and others, and Mr. English, and then Mr. Ryle, never, and today Mr. McLay, have never given an explanation as to why they did nothing. No minister, sir, has been accountable. No one resigned. No one was sacked. No one on the board was sacked. No one in the management was disciplined. That is absolutely true. They resigned and they ran. They ran as the ship sank. No one was required to go. But the people who paid the price, sir, and are paying today are the hundreds of staff on the coalface, literally, who keep the show on the rolls. West Coast miners, sir. They could have reacted. What could the government have done? They could have called in the management and the board and said, where's your B plan? Like every other coal company did around the world, and they survived. If the board had said no, they could have sacked the board. No, they did nothing. Or they could have changed the statement of corporate intent, sir, and then put some direction in. They were the tools that this government could have used. And as Mr. Brownlee grins away, as people worry about their jobs, and other people on the West Coast are looking for jobs as a result of his government's inaction, they will note that down. I say to the government, come clean. I say to the government, for once since 2009, since taking office, explain to the New Zealand people why you took no action, why you refused to intervene on the board, why you allowed the outlandish expenditure, and why no one from the government, from the board, from management has ever been held accountable for this. They sit there, sir, as they wasted $389 million of taxpayers' money and point the finger at everybody else. Well, the buck stops with them. They should get up. The Minister of Finance should make a ministerial explanation today and explain why he sat there with Tony Ryle, with the government and the Prime Minister, and let Solid Energy be run into the ground.
Good speech. Do nothing,
government. Hear, hear.
Labour's Clayton Cosgrove was joined by his opposition colleagues in New Zealand First and the Greens in asking the Speaker for an urgent debate.
I have received letters from Richard Prosser, the Honourable Clayton Cosgrove and Gareth Hughes seeking to debate under Standing Order 389, the announcement today that Solid Energy has been placed in voluntary administration. This is a particular case of recent occurrence involving ministerial responsibility. The announcement makes it clear that Solid Energy has been placed into temporary voluntary administration and that in the meantime it would continue to operate normally under its existing board of directors. It has been reported that there are no plans for redundancies during the period of administration. While being placed in voluntary administration is significant, the longer-term outcome of that decision is not yet known. The business of the House should not be set aside just because an announcement has been made, even though it may be important. There must be such an element of urgency that the matter must take precedent over other business. In this instance, I am not persuaded that there is an element of urgency that warrants the setting aside of the business of the House. The application is therefore declined.
Now from the heat of the debating chamber to the cool, calm reasoning of the committee rooms with Rhys Lyon.
Among the 15 select committee meetings held during the week, the Social Services Committee heard submissions on the Support for Children in Hardship Bill, which would require parents on a benefit to work 20 hours a week once their youngest child turns three. Making a submission on the bill was Federation of Business and Professional Women representative Helen Swales, who pointed to problems with the bill.
When you're forcing people to go and take any job, that equates to 20 hours, because that's what you're saying, you want them to be gainfully employed at part-time. Well, when you look at certain sectors or parts of the country, that's not always possible. The quality of the jobs that are there are not always highly paid. Some of them don't even, you could argue, what is a minimum pay wage? Will minimum salary for a person on a solo benefit get them off the benefit and give them a standard of living and that takes them out of poverty? We don't believe that that does.
Ms. Swales said many parents on benefits did want to get back into the workforce.
A lot of these women do want to get off the benefit, and we need to put the framework in place that makes it easy for them to do it, and it does get them out of that poverty hardship. I think just demanding or regulating that they have to go back to work at three is not always the best option, I don't think, for them. And that's basically what this is saying. This piece of legislation is saying that when the child turns three, we're saying you have to go back, and that annually we will check to make sure that you're doing everything that you should be.
Federation of Business and Professional Women representative Helen Swales with that submission on the Support for Children in Hardship Bill. Among other committee meetings held during the week, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee was briefed on the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, and the Justice and Electoral Committee continued its inquiry into the 2014 election.
We should make it as easy as possible for people to vote.
That suggestion to the Justice and Electoral Committee came from Green Party General Secretary Gwen Shaw.
We should make it as convenient, as relaxed, as friendly for all those people where English is not their first language, migrants who might not have been here more than 2 years and are just able to vote. All those people need our legislation and our Electoral Commission, who do a great job, to take advantage of the best ways of being able to vote.
Green Party General Secretary Gwen Shaw with that submission to the Justice and Electoral Committee's inquiry into the 2014 election. Back in the chamber, Green MP Russell Norman had this question for Trade Minister Tim Grosser on Thursday.
Does he have any concerns about the inclusion of investor-state dispute settlement provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, provisions which allow multinational companies to sue governments in secretive offshore tribunals? And if so, what are those concerns?
The Honourable Tim Grosser.
Mr Speaker, I would have a number of concerns about signing up to an investor-state dispute settlement provision in any trade agreement that did not protect the right of future governments to regulate in the public interest, that allowed non-transparent and unfair procedures to apply, or would encourage frivolous claims by foreign corporations that would have no merit in the legal sense. Happily, I can inform the House that this government will not be signing an agreement that does not meet any of those basic political and judicial tests.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Dr. Russell Norman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How can he be confident that ISDS provisions don't put New Zealand at risk when the German government is currently being sued under ISDS for $7 billion for trying to phase out nuclear power plants by a company called Vattenfall, a company that has already used ISDS threats to stop the German government from putting environmental regulations on a new coal-fired power plant?
The Honourable Tim Grosser.
Mr Speaker, I won't go into the entrails of that particular dispute, which is not, in fact, an attempt by the company to stop a democratically elected German government from shifting its policy on nuclear power. It is about the financial implications of that decision. The reality is that we will not be signing up to an agreement that does not cover the basic interests of New Zealand.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Dr. Russell Norman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, to the Minister, has the Minister seen the June report from the Australian Productivity Commission, a commission established by the Conservative Prime Minister John Howard, where the Australian Productivity Commission opposed the inclusion of ISDS provisions in trade agreements, including explicitly the TPP, because of concerns about ISDS on the ability of the Australian government to regulate?
The Honourable Tim Grosser.
Mr. Speaker, no, I've not personally seen that particular report, but what I am aware of is that the Australian government, and of course I'm in closest consultation with my counterpart Australian Minister, is arguing for exactly the same balanced approach to ISDS as is the New Zealand government.
Trade Minister Tim Grosser. I'm Rhys Lyon reporting for ParliamentToday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.